Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Only the coadjuvation of any key is confounded as far as the Srila Prabhupada. Premsi Kosi Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sriya Dvaita Piraya Kivasari Gaur Bhattava Nikhi. Sri Sri Hare Krishna Gopinath Swami Pindaradi Kundi Giri Govardhan. Sri Vrindavan Dham. Sri Navati Padama Ki Jai. Rangamayi Ki Jai. Dhunamayi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Devi Ki Jai. Samaveda Bhaktivan Nikhi Jai. All glorious is the Lord. 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 Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sthavita Srimati Bhakti Pranta Sramdaya Namaste Saraswati Devi Gaur Bhavi Sarani Sri Krishna Bhavi. Om Sri Chaitanya Mahavishnam, Sapitana Deva Vichare, Sayam Upatadamayam, Adati Sapamantika. Vansha Kapa Chulascha, Vipassana Vajivacha, Vikitanam Prabhupada. I would like to thank you for coming, everyone. I would like to start a presentation that, Krishna willing, will take three different classes. And it's called Fluid Reality, Fixed Absolute Truth. Now, what we're saying about reality is that it's always shifting, and rather the absolute truth is always is constant. Now, I've left this picture on because especially, well, who knows why? What is, of course, this is a tree around Govardhan that's very, very old, and it's a pilu tree, so we can look at it like that. But notice how tangled it is. I mean, it's not as tangling as an old banyan tree, but it's quite tangled. So why do I want this picture on here now? And the answer is because this tree is like our minds. Very, very, very tangled. And if you move from one, welcome. Thank you. You okay?
Yes.
You feel happy today?
Yes.
This is a tree. A very tangled tree. And not that it was originally planned to be there because of this reason, but in our presentation, it's going to represent the mind. And the mind tends to be very tangled. And if you follow one branch to the next, 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 to well, you can see the direction my hand is going. You just go around in circles. And it's very hard to unentangle oneself from the complexities of the mind. But in this presentation, not... stop that. You cat. Quick, bring the dog police. Where's Oma's dog when we need him? Your dog will probably make good friends with him, though. What does he want? Okay. Come in for kirtan, of course. You're welcome, cat, but outside. So this in this presentation is one of the points that's going to be described as the perfection of yoga. And that perfection of yoga unentangles
the tangles of the mind. And practically speaking, or actually speaking, there is no other way to unentangle the tangles of the mind ultimately. They can be eased, and they should be eased when the tangles cause us too much trouble. But the ultimate process of unentangling or cutting through the great tangles of the mind will be described. But that's not all that's going to be described. That's just the first element of the presentation, and it's going to be described quite indirectly in one sense. But I just wanted to make that point. Now, a second point that I found interesting. In this presentation today, on this very day, in part two, we're going to watch a cartoon. Yes. Now, I was wondering, why is it? Raise your hand if you secretly like cartoons. Okay. But why are cartoons attractive? Did you ever wonder?
Funny.
Huh?
Innocent.
But why are they attractive?
It's full of life.
Huh?
It's full of life. Not dying.
But of course it's not full of life. It's just a cartoon.
Yeah.
But still.
You are not dying of anything.
Huh?
You are not dying.
You're not dying?
You cannot die.
In a cartoon?
Yes.
Okay. All interesting answers. Not quite what I was thinking. No, but especially, who likes cartoons? And they sort of speak to the child within us. They speak to the child within. But what is it in the child that likes cartoons? And what is it within us that appreciates cartoons? What do you think, Kami?
It's simple.
It's simple, but they're like, yeah? It's not reality, but why do we like them?
Imagination.
Because Al-Hus said that, yes. It evokes a lot of imagination. It gives and it really is going to point to something that comes out really strongly in this presentation, is that it was very interesting for me to hear all the reasons why people like cartoons and... This is obviously a very deep Krishna conscious subject, isn't it? Why people like cartoons. But but we bring a lot into it. And it seems to me that children tend to see, and we do too, and that's the point, that we tend to see a caricature of reality. We don't actually see reality. But we see a caricature of reality, and then with our own imaginations, with our own minds, we fill in so many things, and therefore it's attractive. It just provides the basic outline of something, and then the mind fills in all the rest, and you don't notice that it's not real after a while. And actually, that's one of the secrets of good writing, by the way, in case any of you are interested in becoming good writers, and is that you have to pick the right detail when you describe something. You have to pick the right detail that causes the reader's mind to fill in everything else. And if you try to do the work of the imagination of the reader and tell every detail, they'll just fall asleep. You just have to pick the right detail, the exact detail that will cause the imagination or the mind of the person who's reading it to fill in all the rest. So I think it's something like that with a cartoon, and it's appealing for that way because it engages the mind to project a whole set of imaginary things that aren't actually there on the... Anyway, that's Bergeron's theory of cartoonology. Maybe we could start a new religious movement with it. Cartoonism. Are you a cartoonist? But okay, now we'll present, because this is actually quite a serious presentation, Krishna willing. It's actually quite philosophical, and even parts will be quite scientific, but bear with us and it will... Okay. Now let's see if our magic technology will work today. Yes. Please read.
Fluid reality, fixed absolute truth.
I was pointing to you, son, not to you. Okay. Fluid reality, fixed absolute truth. The two presentations. Fluid means always moving. And this fluid reality is not actually a reality. It's illusion. We imagine it to be reality, but it's actually illusion. And that is what one of the difficulties of life is. We impose a sense of fixedness on something that we consider reality, and then when it shifts and falls apart, we get very disturbed. But actually, in fact, it wasn't reality at all. And one devotee who lives in Christchurch, New Zealand, he was describing what it was like when there were earthquakes several years ago. And I was there right after the earthquakes, and it's quite an interesting experience that you're doing something, or sleeping even, and suddenly the building starts shaking like this, back and forth and back and forth for about a minute. And then even though you might not be frightened on one level, your body becomes terrified and the heart starts beating. And then at any time, at any place, and sometimes it was happening, what they call aftershocks, 100, 200 aftershocks a day, like this. So you'd be just anywhere at any time. And what is not supposed to be happening, because you're expecting, this is what we rely on all day long. This is our security. We rely on it being here. We rely on it being stable. And actually, it's not stable, in fact. So when I say fluid reality, I really mean fluid illusion. And rather, reality is is fixed. So somehow or another, the ultimate point is that if we can see the reality behind the illusion, then wherever we are, we will be in a very safe and stable position, because we're dealing with reality. And if we're dealing with illusion, as Rohini Nandana well knows, if we're dealing with illusion, what wins? If there is a conflict between reality and illusion, what will prevail?
Illusion.
You're reading the wrong cartoons. what will prevail? Whenever anyone says that, I challenge them to, with their full heart and determination and belief, believe that the wall has no true existence, and then run as fast as you can into it and see what happens, which will win, illusion or reality. So reality always triumphs over illusion, but only 100% of the time, so don't worry. Reality always wins. So if we can, and reality is actually the most wonderful of all things, because ultimately reality is the most wonderful of all people. So we'll get there eventually. But first, these two lessons today, these two presentations, if we ever get to them, will be about fluid reality or illusion. Yes. Now, do we have we don't have the sound working, do we?
Yeah, we're trying.
Huh? Where is the little plug? We just have to put it into, yes. This should do something. So when it's time for sound, you'll be ready.
Yeah.
Now, our presentation begins. Part one, reality and our perception of reality. Now, this is Uddhava at the feet of Krishna in Dwarka. And when Uddhava takes shelter of Krishna in Dwarka, which is described in the sixth chapter of the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, Uddhava fears and rightly so, because he's greatly intelligent, he fears that it is time for Krishna to end his pastimes in this world. He's going to leave this world. And Uddhava, because his loving relationship with Krishna is so deep, he doesn't wish to be in this world without Krishna. So he says to Lord Krishna, please take me with you. And Krishna, in response, tells him that I have some service for you to do here. You stay behind. And he speaks the Uddhava Gita, what's called the song of Krishna. It's interesting, it's called the Uddhava Gita, but it's Krishna is singing it to Uddhava. And it goes from till the 29th chapter of the 11th canto, so from the 6th to the 29th, so it's very, very long. Now, in the 13th chapter, there's a very interesting pastime that's described when Uddhava asks Krishna a very interesting question that everyone knows that acting in specific ways will cause them trouble and not bring them happiness but bring them misery. But yet, why is it that people act in those ways? Against their own welfare. So in the course of Krishna's reply to Uddhava, he tells a story, a pastime, of the descent of the avatar known as the Hansa avatar. Hansa means swan. In reply to a question that the four Kumaras, the gentlemen, the four young gentlemen without pants on, are asking, they ask to Lord Brahma, who can't answer their question. And the Hansa avatar comes. The Hansa avatar comes and replies to this a very, very interesting question that the four Kumaras ask Brahma, and Brahma himself can't answer. So this is the 13th chapter of the 11th canto, text 16 to 17. So the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, Gopal, no, he didn't say Gopal, but could you, Gopal, your turn to read, please.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, once the mental sons of Lord Brahma...
Now this doesn't mean that the sons of Lord Brahma were mental, but it means that they were actually born out of the mind of Brahma.
Namely, the sages headed by Sanaka inquired from their father about the difficult subject matter of the Supreme God, goal of yoga.
Yes, thank you. So they asked their father about the supreme goal of yoga, and they asked the sages headed by Sanaka said, now this is a very interesting question. Now these are the chief of the meditators, and they're asking this question, the most perfected meditators. O Lord, people's minds are naturally attracted to material sense objects. And similarly, the sense objects in the form of desire enter within the mind. So our minds, or people's, which is including everyone, including the cat, our minds enter into sense objects. They actually affect the sense objects. They enter into it. And similarly, the mind is in the sense objects, and the sense objects in the form of desires, they live in our minds. They enter into our minds. So if one wants to become free from the difficulties of the mind and all the sense objects in the mind, then you can't go anywhere to escape it, because it follows you. The sense objects are very well and alive in the mind, and they follow you. And the mind, similarly, is and people can experience this. This happens many times. You're staring at someone, and they turn around because they're experiencing your consciousness and touching their consciousness. So many things like that. So what they want to know is, now how is it possible for me to focus my mind? And these are the best of meditators, the gurus, the teachers of all other meditators. And they're asking this question, how is it possible to just focus my mind on the absolute truth and not have the sense objects enter my mind and disturb my meditation on the absolute truth? Anyway, I think it's an interesting question. So here's Burujan's summary. The mind enters the sense objects, and the sense objects enter the mind. Have you ever... because we usually don't think of the mind having the ability to affect a physical non-conscious thing. But I've noticed also, I was trying to think of an example, is that when people are in the mode of ignorance and they go to I don't know what you call it in Israel, but in Australia they call them, in England they call them pubs, in the United States bars, what do you call them here?
Pubs and bars.
So I've walked past some of those places, of course I would never enter. But I've, although in my eighth past, but anyway, that's. And it's like ignorance just like pours out of there, even though there may be no people in there, but the consciousness of the people in there has affected the place. So much so that you can experience the place just walking nearby the place, and it's ignorant. Or if you walk into, no offense, a lawyer's office. Did you ever walk into a lawyer's office in a meeting? Because it's like heavy vibration. Did you ever notice that? Anyway. Or on the other hand, if you walk into a temple or a holy place, the vibration of there is supposed to be very uplifting. It usually is very uplifting. So the places are affected. You take an ordinary house, and people have extraordinary consciousness there, and the place gets affected by that consciousness. So the mind enters the sense objects, and the sense objects enter the mind. So here's going back to the question that they're asking. Therefore, how can a person who desires liberation, who desires to cross over activities of sense gratification, destroy this mutual relationship between the sense objects and the mind? Please explain this to us. That they're so intertwined. So how to have a mind, and this is what impersonalists basically try to do. They try to have a mind that has no content. No content of any sense object, either hearing, fragrance, touch, sound, or anything visual. And there's actually I don't remember how many years ago, several hundred years ago, there's a Jewish Kabbalist who tried to do this Abalafia by just repeating numbers. He worked out if you just repeat numbers in a more or less a whimsical way, the mind at some point becomes empty of all context because the numbers won't have any meaning. And this is what he was trying to do, to have a mind free from any content. So how is it possible? How is it possible to have a mind free from content? And what is the world like? Because if the mind is affecting what we see, just like with the cartoon, if the mind is affecting what we see, what is reality minus the mind? It's a little technical, excuse me. It's a bit late at night after a hard day's work for this kind of a thing, but what to do? What is actual objective reality? And this is what the scientists are trying to find out through their use of experimentation, by trying to remove, making it theoretically so objective that the mind doesn't influence what is seen. This is what their attempt is, but it's actually not possible at all. It's actually not possible. What they're trying to do is to see, to describe what reality is without the subjective experience of the scientist or the observer interfering with what reality is. Is that clear? So that's what they're trying to do. And that's something like what their question is. It's very, very, very deep. Is it possible to separate the observer, the one who's observing, from that which is being observed? And the reason why they want to do it is because they want to meditate free from the influences of the outside world. They want to meditate. So this is their question. And Lord Brahma he is unable to answer the question. So here's my simple summary of this. The mind and the senses are so interconnected that these greatest of jnana yoga devotees are inquiring whether or not the senses and the sense objects can be separated. Now this is more relevant than just a theoretical question, is because, and this is one of the themes of this part of the presentation, is that we see something in this world and we see it as if it is reality, but actually speaking, we're not seeing reality. We're seeing a mixture of whatever it is out there, plus our own mind's interpretation of it. We're not actually seeing reality. And therefore, as probably I'll mention it later, whenever there's a car accident and there are 20 witnesses and you ask each of the witnesses what happened, and you'll get 20 different stories about what had happened. And they're just, it's so much the mind. And yet, everyone so arrogantly believes that my vision is the correct vision. There's one statistic that they started re-examining when they started using DNA evidence in criminal cases. They re-examined in the United States a certain amount of cases that were affected by the DNA evidence, and they found out that out of all the law cases that were overturned because of DNA evidence, 75% of them, the people were convicted by the statement of eyewitnesses, and then it turned out by DNA evidence that they were completely wrong. But 75% of the convictions that were turned over were people who were completely sure that they saw something, and then later the scientific evidence proved that what they saw was not what had happened at all, or what because they didn't see it, they thought they saw it. So it's a very intriguing point here. Can actually the senses and the sense objects, in other words, objective reality, can they actually be separated? So this is what they're asking. Where do the sense objects begin and where does the mind end? When the sense objects when the senses combine with the sense objects, where is the source of the pleasure? Where does the pleasure come from? Is it coming from the senses? Is it coming from the object? Is the pleasure in the senses? Is it in the sense object? Where does the pleasure come from? Is it in the mind? Is it a combination of the senses, the sense object, and the mind? So these are all intriguing things. Did you get hungry for strawberries when you saw that? But where does the pleasure come from? So here Srila Prabhupada speaks.
We are in this material world.
So where does the good taste of the Nafi reside? Is it in the person? Is it in his mind? Is it in the Nafi? Is it somewhere in between? Is it both? So what is it, where this connection between the sense objects and the senses is very much what we see, what we perceive as reality. It is so far from reality, otherwise the whole world would agree that either Nafi is the most wonderful of all foods or the most abominable of all foods. But people are completely different in how they perceive and what they consider reality. So there is one verse from the Upanishads, Brihadaranyaka Upanishads. One sees by the mind and hears by the mind. It's not that there is no reality out there, but what that reality is, no one can agree upon because of the influence of the mind. So again, the question that the four sages asked was, how do you separate the mind from the objective world, the objects of the senses? So that was the end of part one. There is reality and our perception of reality. Now everyone considers that what I see is real, but it's actually not, because no one can agree what that real is. So now we will move to part two. And just as I was, yes. Hold on tight. Yes. So, do we know how to work the sound, make it louder, from that comes out of the headphones?
It should be 100 over there.
But it was up as high as it could here, so I think it would have something to do with here.
It was on max.
Yeah. Well, something's not working quite right. So another presentation on fluid reality. Oops. Part two, defining illusion. Here is one definition of illusion. Perception of an object that suggests a false belief as to its nature. So when we think of something, we perceive an object, but we don't get a true understanding of its actual nature, what the object actually is, due to our perception. That is how we are defining illusion. And people, could you please read?
People and tend to accept reality so what they see.
As what they see. People tend. But the Hansa avatar presents quite a different view of reality. And we shall later hear of that. We tend to think reality is what we see. But modern science also presents quite a different view other than reality is what one sees. Now, it's going to be quite awkward if we can't make the sound proper because it's...
No, it's making too much noise. Huh?
No, now it's okay, but when it comes to from the
yeah,
machine...
We'll have to see when it comes and
push the buttons. Okay. Okay.
Here we are, the granddaddy of all quantum weirdness, the infamous double-slit experiment.
Can you hear?
To understand this experiment, we first need to see how particles, or little balls of matter, act. If we randomly shoot a small object, say a marble, at the screen, we see a pattern on the back wall where they went through the slit and hit. Now, if we add a second slit, we would expect to see a second band duplicated to the right. Now, let's look at waves. The waves hit the slit and radiate out, striking the back wall with the most intensity directly in line with the slit. The line of brightness on the back screen shows that intensity. This is similar to the line the marbles make. But when we add the second slit, something different happens. If the top of one wave meets the bottom of another wave, they cancel each other out. So now, there is an interference pattern on the back wall. Places where the two tops meet are the highest intensity, the bright lines, and where they cancel, there is nothing. So, when we throw things, that is, matter, through two slits, we get this. Two bands of hits. And with waves, we get an interference pattern on many bands. Good so far. Now, let's go quantum. An electron is a tiny, tiny bit of matter, like a tiny marble. Like fire streaming through one slit. It behaves just like the marble, a single band. So, if we shoot these tiny bits through two slits, we should get, like the marbles, two bands. What? An interference pattern. We fire electrons, tiny bits of matter through. But we get a pattern like waves, not like little marbles. How? How could pieces of matter create an interference pattern like a wave? It doesn't make sense. But physicists are clever. They thought maybe those little balls are bouncing off each other and creating that pattern. So they decide to shoot electrons through one at a time. There is no way they can interfere with each other. But after an hour of this, the same interference pattern is seen to emerge. The conclusion is inescapable. The single electron leaves as a particle, becomes a wave of potentials, goes through both slits, and interferes with itself to hit the wall like a particle. But mathematically, it's even stranger. It goes through both slits, and it goes through neither. And it goes through just one, and it goes through just the other. All of these possibilities are in superposition with each other. But physicists were completely baffled by this. So, they decided to peek and see which slit actually goes through. They put a measuring device by one slit to see which one it went through and let it fly. But the quantum world is far more mysterious than they could have imagined. When they observed, the electron went back to behaving like a little marble. It produced a pattern of two bands, not an interference pattern of many. The very act of measuring or observing which slit it went through meant it only went through one, not both. The electron decided to act differently, as though it was aware it was being watched. And it was here that physicists step forever into the strange, never world of quantum events. What is matter? Marbles or waves? And waves of what? And what does an observer have to do with any of this? The observer collapsed the wave function simply by observing.
Well, so the scientists who are trying to find out what objective reality is using their great intelligence, when you try to separate through the intelligence, the mind, the observer, and your means of observing from the sense object, from the objects, from objective reality, it becomes extremely, extremely, extremely bewildering. And rather than being able to answer the question, what is reality, they become more and more confused, and what their conclusions are make less and less sense. One scientist offered these words to indicate what he derived from this experiment. This isn't a big famous scientist, but just a scientist. This was his conclusion after dealing with this type of quantum mechanical experiment. We don't know very much about this universe. Science is not yet an exact science. This is more of his words. As we study smaller and smaller particles in order to understand more about what we're made of, we seem to find more things that just don't make sense. So what does that mean? The more you try to parse, separate the mind from the outside world so you don't affect the outside world, and the more you try to, using your own intelligence, understand what reality is, the more things become confusing and bewildering, and the less you know if you use this methodology. Another quotation. The point is that nothing should be ruled out completely because we simply cannot know anything for certain at this point. So what is reality? Because we've been speaking about fluid reality, and by that we mean illusion that's always changing. And the scientific theories always change. And the scientific methodologies of understanding what is reality, what is objective reality, ultimately, it's so gross, actually. It's so unsubtle. It's gross. What do? They take a cyclotrons or something, particle smashers or atomic. So what they do, basically, using magnetic waves, using magnetic fields, they take a particle, an atomic particle, and they speed it up and speed it up till it's going faster and faster and faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. And then they take some particle there, and then boom, they bang that speeding particle into, it's something like what they do to the rocks out here. They take a huge mechanical hammer and they break a rock. So they try to do the same thing. It's very, very gross. It's not subtle science, actually. So they try to break apart that atomic particle into its component pieces. And then they take one of those component pieces, and then they make a bigger, faster cyclotron, and they speed up a particle, and then boom, and and they try to find out what that's made of. And then if they can find a smaller one, they... And in this way, rather than finding answers or whatever answers they find, it brings up so many more questions. So that methodology, even though we don't agree with it as a method to find ultimate reality, the absolute truth, to discover the spiritual world, it really has come up to the same conclusion that the meditator Four Kumaras came up with, is that how do you separate the mind from the sense objects so you actually know what those sense objects are, so you actually know what it is that exists outside of you? And the answer is, you can't. And the deeper that you try to find out what it is, the more you delve into separating the two, the practically speaking, the more your ignorance increases, the less you know. The deeper the questions become. So here are some questions that at least I thought were interesting that I came up with after understanding this point. Because how did we start this particular class, defining what illusion is? An illusion was, does anyone remember?
Something appears to have a different...
Yeah, you think it's one thing, but it's actually something else. So one question that I came up with this is that not even scientists truly understand reality implies that everyone is more or less an illusion. In other words, our perception of reality isn't actually reality at all. And if it's not reality and yet we think it is reality, but none of us can agree upon what reality is, then that means that everyone is more or less an illusion. So the question is, well, where did that illusion come from? Where did that potency come from that separates? Or where is the source of that illusion that is so powerful that no one can pierce beyond it and see what reality actually is? So what is the source of illusion? And also, the concept of illusion implies the existence of reality. Just as the condition of being impure implies the existence of purity. So just the concept illusion, that everyone is illusion, means there's a reality and no one understands what it is. And it's something like, the way I look at it, is it's something like, maybe we can make this just a little bit louder. It's something like if you take an iPhone and place it before someone who doesn't know what an iPhone is. An iPhone is a smartphone, right? So someone sees his friend walking with his earphones in, and he's, oh, this is an MP3 player, and then he sees someone else. It's a camera, and someone sees. If it's an iPhone, I think you say Siri, right? Okay, Siri. You know, what's the weather? What's the weather today?
The weather today in Hurry says blah, blah, blah.
So it's a weather forecast. Is it an MP3 player? Is it this? Is it that? Or is it a phone? So is it a wave? Is it a particle? Is it this? Is it that? So that implies that it's obviously something. Matter is obviously something. It appears that sometimes to be a wave. It appears sometimes to be a particle. Just like the iPhone appears sometimes to be an MP3 player, appears sometimes to be a camera, sometimes to be a phone, sometimes of this, sometimes of that. But actually, what's lacking is the concept, a broader, more abstract concept that includes the lesser concept that's big enough to include those other things. So the concept of iPhone includes those other things, the camera, the weather forecaster, the MP3 player, the this, the that. So it seems clear that that matter is something. There it is, it exists, it is something. But the fact that no one knows that great concept, the greater concept that reconciles all the different seemingly contradictory characteristics that it performs. So what is that concept? So they use gross means to find it. What is that subsuming more abstract concept that includes everything else? They use very, very, very gross methods, the cyclotron, etc., and using the. But these, but the problem is, it's always the same, that your consciousness, the very act of observing, affects how you perceive it. So therefore. And this will come to very soon, the subtle ways of understanding these greater concepts, the more subtle ways, not gross ways, but the subtle ways, the first thing you do is try to purify your consciousness. To make purified consciousness means consciousness that's subtle. And that is why our attempt is to live a certain lifestyle, a Krishna conscious lifestyle, with the no meeting, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, because and living, getting up early and going to sleep early and bathing and cleanliness, they all promote goodness, making the consciousness very subtle so that one can perceive in a subtle way. One can perceive reality in its subtle forms. Because what's obvious to one person whose consciousness is very dull is going to be completely or covered, or is going to be completely different. What he perceives is going to be as reality is completely different from what a person whose consciousness is very subtle perceives as reality. Like you go to a heavy metal rock concert, and people are, you know, a certain kind of people who have certain consciousness think that, you know, that's heaven itself. But then you take a person who has cultivated a very fine taste of a very fine orchestral symphonic music, and you know, they go like this, you know, and you put the person who likes heavy metal into the, and they go like, you know, they just fall asleep. Because the consciousnesses are so different. So, the fact that things that are, that there are contradictory elements implies that there is, because it exists, it's there, but what is it? It's very hard to say unless you have the right consciousness. So then, therefore, there's our answer. What is the reality behind the illusion? And it's Krishna. He's the subsuming, I mean, we don't like to call him a subsuming concept, but the reality is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's what we would like to say. And it's very scientifically shown in the Bhagavatam. So we'll first discuss illusion and its effects. So, and then we'll discuss what reality is. So here, so what is the effect of illusion? When people are consciousness are filled with the passions and ignorance, and their desires are dictating, and they're increasing their desires. If you have that type of a consciousness. Oh, look at this one. Can you okay, what is it? Does it change before your eyes what it is? And once you see one, do you notice that once you... what do you see? Who sees the old man? And who sees the dog and the lady holding the baby and the old Mexican probably fellow? And once you see one, it's hard to see the other one again. Who doesn't see both yet? Okay, just keep looking. It will reveal itself. It sort of shifts right before your eyes. Which one do you see right now?
Depends what I look to.
Okay, but you're seeing both?
Yeah.
Okay. So which is it? Which is it? It's both. This is illusion. So placing and keeping a soul in illusion, ignorance about what reality actually is, including the creation of false beliefs. False beliefs meaning it's this, you know, an argument. Well, no, it's an old man. No, it's two people, a couple and a dog. No, it's an old man. No, it's a couple and a dog. No, I told you it was an old man. I see it. No, it's a couple and a dog. If you don't stop seeing it, saying it's an old man, oh, welcome to the material world. Sounds like Israel politics, doesn't it? So this is a function of Maya. This is what Maya does. It gives every. This is what false ego does. This is what illusion is. It gives everyone the impression that they are seeing reality as it is. But actually no one is seeing reality as it is. If they are seeing, well, what is reality as it is. So in this regard, as to what the effects of illusion are, Krishna says in the Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto again, when philosophers argue, I don't choose to analyze this particular case in the same way that you have. It is simply my own, Krishna saying, it is my own insurmountable energies motivating their analytical disagreement. It's Krishna's potency, Maya. And Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments on this text saying, the causes of the quarrels of such men who are disagreeing, the causes of all the quarreling are my energies, the potent functions of my illusory Maya. That is to say, the energy of illusion manifesting as each of those arguments. And then he quotes from the Hansakuya prayers, let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the all-pervading Supreme Personality of Godhead, who possesses unlimited transcendental qualities. And acting from within the cores of the hearts of all philosophers who propagate various views, he causes them to forget their own souls. It covers their ability to see themselves. This is what Maya does. And sometimes they agree, and sometimes they disagree amongst themselves, but they don't see themselves at all. Rather, they're so caught up in the bubble of their own consciousness, thinking that that is reality. Thus, this is from the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, thus he, the Supreme Lord, creates in this material world a situation in which they are unable to come to any conclusion. He, his Maya, his illusion is so powerful, I offer my obeisances to him. There will never be a conclusion, even though I've heard some of the best, most intelligent scientists of the day say we're just a few years from understanding that ultimate particle, that God particle, that is the ultimate reality. And then we will understand everything. And what was it? Who was telling me yesterday that there was somebody? What were you saying? What was he believing? He's like this great intelligent person.
In 30 years,
man will be immortal. So they'll be able to download their consciousness onto computers and on and on and on. What happens if the electricity goes out? people believed that. I remember when Walt Disney died, he had his body frozen, thinking that in 30 years or 40 years they're going to be able to solve all the diseases that they have, and then they just thaw him out and just fix him up. But I don't know if he's still frozen, but more than 40 years. Excuse me?
Someone took the plug out.
Is that true, or are you just making that up? How dare you, Prabhu? But these people are such believers. And even like the atheists of the world, they have such conviction on their atheism, they have so much faith. What to do? But it's all by the potency of Krishna's illusion of Maya, and no one can crack this illusion by their power. So one effect of illusion, therefore, is quarrels, arguments and politics, where everyone thinking 100% that my viewpoint is the correct one and everyone else is wrong. This is Maya. This is one of the effects of illusion. Oops. So Bhagavatam, second chapter of the 11th canto, also describes another basic effect of Maya. Fear arises when a living entity misidentifies himself as the material body because of absorption in the external illusory energy of the Lord. Whoops. When the living entity thus turns away from the Supreme Lord, he also forgets his own constitutional position as a servant of the Lord. This bewildering, fearful condition is affected by the potency for illusion called Maya. So the first effect of Maya is all the arguing, all the politics, intense disagreement, because everyone is convinced that my viewpoint is reality. So the second one is fear. This is what occurs by being involved in Krishna's illusory energy. And more effects of Maya? Those states of existence that are conceived of as separate from the Supreme Personality of Godhead have no actual existence. Now, each of these verses are so deep and so potent and powerful that you can meditate upon them and understand exactly what's going on in the world and in our own selves. So this one is, but we don't have time to speak deeply about really any of them, but just an overview of the points. But please listen to this, that those states of existence that are conceived of as separate from the Supreme Personality of Godhead have no actual existence. Because the definition of the Absolute Truth is that nothing is outside of it. Nothing is external to it. So if we are perceiving something as not without its connection to the Absolute Truth, we're perceiving something as reality that has no actual existence. That's the point here. And that state of consciousness in which we perceive anything as not connected to the Supreme Absolute Truth, it creates quarrels, it creates arguments, dissension, and fear. But it creates within the heart a sense of separation from the Absolute Truth, a deep sense that something is inherently missing. I'm feeling incomplete. Just as the seer of a dream imagines many different activities and rewards, similarly, because of the sense of an existence separate from the Lord's existence and its illusion, but because of the sense of existence separate from the Lord's existence, the living entity falsely performs fruitive activities, thinking them to be the cause of future rewards and destinations. If I do this, I'm going to get this and be happy. And if I do that, I'm going to get that. And if I do this. And his whole life is spent in this plan making. I'm going to get this. And when I get that, I'll do this. And when I do that, I'll get this. And this one's in my way, and I'll just push them out of the way. And I'll do this, and I'll do that. Just dreaming. This is Maya. Not seeing the connection of anything in reality, of everything in reality, to the Absolute Truth, to Krishna, is an effect of illusion. And the effect of this is isolation and frustration. So dissension, fighting, arguments, fear, isolation and frustration, that basically defines contemporary life. Plus debt, credit cards and debt. That we don't have a verse to. So this is the end of part two. We're talking about illusion, that trying to understand objectively what is reality in answer to the questions that the four Kumaras asked. And that's the end of our presentation. And for the next, not, what's the next, not tomorrow, not, the next, huh? Thursday evening we'll start talking about not illusion but reality is and the methodologies of perceiving reality.
What about Wednesday?
Wednesday?
No.
Is Wednesday the appearance day of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur? Is it? Oh, that's Thursday. Okay. Wednesday, there may be something, but
it's not scheduled.
Not scheduled. That
time. We can reschedule.
Unless we reschedule.
We can see. We're going to go on an adventure on Wednesday. So we'll see if we come back. Okay, are there any questions? It's a bit late though, but are there any questions about this presentation? I find it interesting. It's a bit late at night for this kind of interesting stuff, but why don't we see how to get it?
It's called better late than never.
Yeah. How do we? Yes. Come on, be good. Cooperate. Yes. Go back to the tangle. So the point being that to unentangle our consciousness from illusion, that's what we'll talk about. On Thursday, it seems. So why don't we put the lights on and ask if there's any questions? Maybe some hands will go up if the lights are on. And then we'll end at 8:30. Yes.
And he also appears as Lord Chaitanya to liberate them from, save them from illusion. So how does that work together?
You have to come to Thursday's class to find out. Because now we're talking about just illusion. Let's talk about illusion for a while. We live in it most of the time. So let's just stick to this for right now.
Yes. Question.
Yeah.
Prabhupada refers to Maya as a picture of different enjoyments, but he doesn't refer to Maya as taking charge of our conception of suffering.
Well, you can't separate the enjoyment from the suffering. They're the heads and tails of the coin. That I want this, I don't want that. This is the illusion that binds everyone. As soon as you want something, along with it comes what you don't want. As soon as you want happiness, you don't want unhappiness. So, but you get one. I'm not sure I'm answering what you're asking of. But Prabhupada doesn't speak about suffering?
But he speaks about suffering about before getting old and so forth.
It says in the Bhagavad Gita, which Prabhupada would quote so many times, a Brahma Bhuvana Loka. From the highest place to the lowest place. There are all places in material existence, all the places of suffering. Because, maybe that's what you're saying, because repeated births and deaths and old age and disease take place there. But there's other verses in the Bhagavad Gita that describe the suffering. Because because the pleasures in this world have a beginning and an end. The Buddha, the wise person, does not take part in them because you want them to continue. And yet, even the very strawberry ice cream that's giving you so much pleasure, it loses its ability to give you pleasure the more you eat. So, and therefore it's so frustrating. but I'm not sure yet that I've answered actually what you're asking.
Then I'll have to find the
word for you. Yeah, okay. As soon as you have found them, please let us know. Anyone else? Yeah.
What is the meaning of the Maha Mantra?
It means the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, and it's simple. There's many, many, many meanings of different depths, depending upon how much we've entered into it. But the basic meaning that Srila Prabhupada gave us is that, O Lord, O Krishna, O energy of the Lord, O Hare, please engage me in your service. Instead of, that's the basic translation, allow me to serve you, please accept me as your servant. The basic idea is that for so many years, for so many lives, I've tried my best to seek happiness as if I was the center of existence, as if the world, the objects of this world were, their existence was for my pleasure. But now I've come to my senses, and now I understand that my natural position is as your servant, so please allow me to serve you. That's the basic meaning.
And Hare is Radharani. How comes Radharani to Hare?
Well, that you can ask either Ram, or who's a Sanskrit scholar. I mean, it's the vocative, it's a way of calling. But you can have that discussion with Ram right after. But he can have the discussion. Don't be miserly. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
So, what is the purpose of Maya? Because there is an objective world, but we can perceive it, and Maya is also potency of Krishna. So, what is the purpose?
What is Maya's purpose?
Yeah.
It's getting a little ahead of ourselves, but those individuals, we can say souls, or we can say individuals, who have some aversion, who do not wish to serve Krishna, who wish to turn their back on Krishna. Krishna gives them a way that they can act independently, as if they were independent, consider themselves independent, and aloof from Krishna. So Maya provides the blockades of reality that they want, because they want to be independent, but it's not possible to be independent of the absolute truth by definition. So Maya provides the illusion required so they can conceive of themselves, think of themselves as independent of Krishna, and try to enjoy as they can. So you more or less need a separate realm of existence to live in, where you consider yourself the supreme, where you're the center, that everything should, all your desires are meant to be fulfilled. And that's what everyone walks around in all day long, this bubble of consciousness, of illusory existence, thinking that they're the center, and getting angry when the whole universe doesn't cooperate with them. And the universe is made specifically not to cooperate with us. I don't know if you've noticed that. it doesn't cooperate with all my plans for enjoyment, because when I want the sun to shine, I want the sun to shine. And when I want it to rain, I want it to rain. I want to never miss a bus. I want the red lights always to turn green when I'm going through. And I want my wife to cook for me all the time, just what I want her to cook. And this and that and this and that. And the universe just refuses to cooperate. I want my stocks to go up and all my enemies' stocks to go down. And and on, and the good guys should always win, and the bad guys should always lose. And I'm living in this illusory world, and I'm so frustrated and isolated, because I'm all alone in this illusion, thinking that I'm the center of existence, and I can't convince anyone to accept that point of view. No one. And in marriage, like the first so many years, tend to be this first, say, 5 years, tend to be this struggle between the husband and wife, because the husband has this illusory, imaginary projection of what his wife is going to be. A cartoon, basically. And the wife has this cartoon going. It's somewhere based on, you know, all the romantic movies they've seen, something about their mother, something about this, something about that, all put together, and everyone concocts this illusion of what the partner is going to be. And then the first years are usually spent fighting whose illusion is going to triumph, trying to mold each other into the illusion that I'm imagining that you're supposed to be. And then that happens until the first kid comes along. And that makes it, and then the first child is, you know, I'm looking, everything has to be centered around me, and the parents are just very good. They have to, because the child's existence is spent on it. So there's a solution. Yes.
I would like to learn from you how you look, for example, what happened yesterday, how you explain it in the illusion way. Yesterday there was a bomb in Sinai, and 12 people were killed, and 12 people were very, very strong damage. And how to handle with this?
How to handle it, or how to explain it according to illusion? Okay, who set off the bomb?
One left that it was suicide.
Okay. Why did he do it?
I can only try to explain.
Okay. What's your understanding why he did it?
He was thinking that this is the right thing to do.
Because I'm a member of one group, one nationality, one people, based on this particular birth, and these people, who I have to show them that they are our enemies, and they have to surrender to our view of things, because they're born in a different kind of body, a different family, a different religion, a different culture. So what is the first effect of illusion that we mentioned? Is all this kind of quarreling and fighting and political disagreement based on the illusion that we are the body. If we understood, if both sides would understand their eternal souls, and they pass from one body to the next, to the next, to the next, and this is only a temporary stop, a little bit of transcendental knowledge would go a long way. So that would be the first thing I would say. Now, how to unentangle this tremendous hatred that's been going on for so many years. I can only say from the transcendental platform how to do it, but without changing the consciousness on a deeper level, they're not going to be able to make a solution. Without transcendental knowledge, you know, they'll make some temporary solution, but everyone still hates each other, so how is it going to be a solution? Because of the ignorance, the maya, the illusion of thinking themselves the body, while not understanding, and what to speak of the killing of all the poor animals. because they like the taste of a cow, they eat it. So you think that, how would you like it if you were a cow? You know, you think there's no reaction, so therefore, so it's a complicated question, and then obviously there's no simple solution to a complicated question except in a theoretical, looking at it on a theoretical platform. So that's a theoretical spiritual platform, but how to apply that to the current reality where no one has any interest in transcendental knowledge is very difficult. But just how different, just how old are you now? You're 60, if I remember correctly. 62, yes. So if you took a movie of your life and of every minute of your life, so in real time it would take 62 years to show that movie. So if you sped it up, so your whole life could be shown in 30 seconds, if you sped it up so fast, and then you added to that, well, I'll just take it at that point. So if you thought of the greatest achievement in your life, how long would that, in that 30-second movie, how long would that achievement last?
10 seconds.
Well, that you must have had a really long special achievement there. But it would take, it wouldn't even be like that. Practically. And then the worst event of your life, how long would that last? So when you look at things from the point of view of eternity, which is the point of view, spiritual point of view, and to what is to be gained on the eternal platform, the temporary wonderful things and the temporary terrible things both take on a different perspective. And then when you add to that movie the movie of your last life before that, and the movie of your life before that, another 30-second movie, and another 30-second movie, and thinking that if you're accepting that you're an eternal soul and you've gone through countless bodies, and then if you connected it, what you did in this life has just like if you do something illegal in this life, and you rob a bank, and you're put in jail, there's a connection between your activity and what happens to you. But if you just see that one segment only of you being put into jail, and you're thinking, well, I didn't do anything. But then when you remember, oh yes, that's right, I did rob that bank. I somehow forgot about it. So a previous life affects this life. And the life before that affects this life, and things like that. So looking at our existence, personal and collective, from a broader perspective, it changes our outlook. So again, a little transcendental knowledge, it would help us very much in viewing things differently. That would be my basic answer. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Any other questions or comments? Mm-hmm. Yes.
In some way we try to connect with Krishna, but this part of illusion is very deep rooted, yes. And we react not on Krishna conscious level. We do not remember connection. Why is this?
So I once asked Prabhupada that question. I was sitting with him, and sometimes when you're with Prabhupada, his personal presence would carry with it the spiritual world. So sometimes when you'd sit with Prabhupada, you would be uplifted by the sweetness of his consciousness. But at other times, you'd stay in your bubble of illusion, misery, and then when you'd be in the presence of Prabhupada, because the contrast was so great, you'd feel 100 times worse even. and you really feel bad. So I asked Prabhupada, why is it that in the present hand of a great soul, that sometimes you could feel completely liberated and other times you'd be in Maya? And his reply was very simple. He said, the intoxication of Maya is very strong. In other words, we have a very long-standing bad habit. We've turned our back to Krishna, on Krishna. And the process of Krishna consciousness is a process of going bahyamukh to samukh, the back turned to facing Krishna. So everyone doesn't turn at the same speed either. Some people, in fact, the reality is that the people who have turned have done the struggle previously. Because how many times, what I've seen in my own life and with many devotees' life, you have an inspiration and you're moving forward and you're looking ahead towards Krishna, and then there's this tendency to look back at what you didn't do and all your regrets and your if only this had happened and if only that had happened. And especially I find as one becomes elderly, and the example I always use for this point is that right now my knees hurt, my ankles hurt, it's hard for me to walk for a long time. And when I was young, I could walk and run all day long. So now when I see young boys and girls running and things like that, there's a part of me that says secretly, if only I could run again. So we all in our life have these things that didn't work out in our lives for us, you know, because I didn't. Some of my friends could so easily learn musical instruments. Some people I know, they could speak foreign languages so easily. Some people are athletic. Some people are tall. Some people are more handsome. Some people even have hair. It's hard to believe, but you know, all the things that I didn't have. Some people have blonde hair. Oh, when I was young, I had curly hair, and one of my friends had blondish hair that was straight, and I sat in front of the mirror when I was a teenager for so long, trying to comb it and make it straight and blonde, and it was just so frustrating. So when we're older, I find that if only syndrome really visits our consciousness. If only I could learn Sanskrit. If only I could play harmonium. If only this and if only that. And each one of those if onlys plants a seed of desire in my heart that Krishna says, oh, you want to learn Sanskrit? That's going to make you happy? Okay. Next life, boom, this is what you want? Okay. Poof. And then you have these abilities that, you know, you want and you deserve. You want to be able to compose symphonies, Mr. Mozart? How would you like, 6 years old, you can compose them. You had such a strong desire when you were, if only I could, I hadn't completed the symphony, it was going through my mind. Oh, and then you're dying, and that desire is dominant in your mind, and boom, poof. So we, in our subtle bodies, in our consciousness, in our minds, we have so many attachments, thinking that if only I have them, I'll be happy. So in this way, according to the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, we wander from branch to branch to branch to branch on the banyan tree of material existence, jumping from one branch to another, looking for the happiness that we so dearly long for. So when we give up all these desires, if our taste in the positive is so strong that it overwhelms, okay, I didn't have this, I didn't have this, I didn't have that. but the taste and sweetness of Krishna's association is so wonderful. Never mind, because after all, all the others are steps to get something else. So what is that? You know, the Sanskrit, the nice hair, the this, the that, the this, the that, the money that I never had, the athletic ability that I never, they're all steps to achieve something else. So instead of, when we come to the conclusion on the core of our hearts that I want you, your service, Krishna, I don't want anything else. And then when we say that to Krishna, I only want you and nothing else, it appears that he says, oh really? Let's see. But the key is the same. Whatever situation you're in life, whatever age you are, no matter whatever anything, whatever body you're in, whatever mind you have, if there's one solution to get out of this tangle that we were talking about there, is that to hold on tightly to the lotus feet of Krishna regardless of what in the world happens, whatever happens. So that's a very difficult, it's not an easy thing, and to see Krishna in everything, it's just so unsuperficial, it's so easy to give a class on it, but it's so difficult when it's happening to me. You know, my mind wants to run in the opposite direction. So until my mind, just as it runs now, as fast as it can, away from Krishna, until it runs to Krishna, regardless of what happens, then I have to stay. But as soon as I, in every circumstance, embrace the lotus feet of Krishna, then practically speaking, you're already there. You don't have to wait. You're already there. You see Krishna in everything. He reveals himself to you in everything. So it's, for most of us, for everyone, it's a gradual process. So, and if the people who are more further down the line, they've paid at a different time. So there's a whole process of moving forward, associating with devotees, chanting Krishna's names, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, tasting the sweetness of Vrindavan, the deities. You know, well, this is what we do. To try to churn our way, on one hand, see the futility of wandering from one branch to the other in the tangle of the material world on one hand, and on the other hand becoming attracted to the sweetness of the spiritual world, of the absolute truth of reality. Any other questions or comments? Because it's getting a bit late. One more, and we'll have a one more question. This with a very short answer, huh?
I'm going to have a lesson on Wednesday. Maybe a very short one.
Yeah, that's a good question. My answer is, we'll see. I told you it would be a short answer. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.